Hello, foreign entanglements viewers. My name is Dr. Rob Farley from the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And today with me is Zach Beauchamp. How are you doing this morning, Zach?
I'm doing good. How are you, Rob?
I'm doing fantastic. I can't remember if you've been on the show before. I think you've been on Blogging Guys before, but maybe if you could remind everyone who you are and what you do.
Sure. I am a reporter blogger at Think Progress, and where I focus in part on foreign affairs and international politics. I'm also the editor of TP Ideas, which is our section on political thought, international relations theory, demographics, and so on and so forth.
Cool. That, I think, makes you particularly appropriate to for the conversation that we're going to have today, which happens to be about the potential for Syria intervention and really the arguments for and against. We're going to talk through some of the arguments for and against, and we're going to talk about sort of our general thoughts about how the debate has proceeded so far, because I think that we're both just a little bit skeptical about the quality of debate thus far. So I guess to start with, I wanted to disaggregate between two different arguments for intervention in Syria, or really two different arguments for different interventions in Syria. The first argument being for what might be conceived as a series of punishment strikes against the Assad regime, the military aspects of the Assad regime, that would directly punish it for the specific offense, so to speak, of using chemical weapons. So I guess, what are your thoughts on the case for this, sort of very limited set of strikes that would presumably be targeted at military installations, et cetera, et cetera? What are your feelings when people talk about this kind of argument?
So I think that it is certainly the strongest basic argument. I mean, there's maybe one other one that I think might be particularly good that we can get back to later, but I think it's the strongest one. And the reason I think it's the strongest one is because the internal logic of it is much more limited than some of the other ones. Mm-hmm. That is to say, there's more of a match between means and ends. When we're saying, like, our means, the only proposed means so far, are a series of offshore cruise missile strikes, because they're the things that would have essentially the least risk for the United States. And the administration right now appears very, very cost-sensitive. That will not alter. There's no world in which that alters the fundamental dynamics on the ground.
Right.
So the question is, what would it accomplish? And the only plausible argument to me, it seems like, for what that actually might, in concrete terms, make a difference about, is the Assad regime's understanding of its ability to use chemical weapons without risking serious punishment from the United States. And that, I think, the signaling features of the strike could potentially save lives in the long run, if you believe that chemical weapons are inherently indiscriminate and might be used en masse and would kill lots of people, which I think is a plausible claim about what chemical weapons are.
Mm-hmm.
And so the crux of the case for the strikes, I think, hinges on the point that this would be perceived as significant punishment enough, or at least a promise of future punishment, to deter the Assad regime from en masse chemical use in the future.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I guess my first question comes down to this, right? Does it have to be specifically at the Assad regime, or can it be third parties who are sort of watching this and are evaluating whether this is going to affect the general prohibition against the use of chemical weapons? And so, I mean, that would be my first thought, right? And so are we going to evaluate the success, or are we going to evaluate the utility of a strike like this specifically with regards to the machinery of sort of military decisions within the Assad regime, or are we going to evaluate it in context of other regimes that might sort of think of using chemical weapons in the same way, but that would witness this and then say, well, this is a line too far, it incurs Western intervention, so to speak, or and so forth. And my second question, I think a lot of people have brought this up with regards to what we're calling the chemical weapons taboo, is that it does seem sort of odd that, you know, the deaths of 800, 1,000, whatever, civilians in this case, it's what really spurs the U.S. to act when, I mean, you've had 100,000 people killed so far in this war. And so doesn't this, in fact, just point out that these taboos that we try to have on things that aren't even really weapons of mass destruction, like chemical weapons, are pointless, and we ought not to take them seriously in the first place?
Right. So see if we can separate this out. Starting with the second one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that is an argument that is true as far as it goes, but I am not quite sure how far it goes. That is, if there was a sort of a world, a possible world, in which the United States were willing to commit, or the United States or allies, or NATO, or Turkey, were willing to commit like sufficient forces to make a difference on the ground, to actually reduce the scale, the mass scale of human suffering, then it would be one thing to make that comparison. Mm-hmm. But all of the available evidence suggests that no one wants to do that. There's no international actor that has either the interest or the willingness or believes that there's a significant enough prospect for success that they would be willing to deploy, a really extended air campaign coordinated with the rebels a la Kosovo, which has its own separate problems,
right.
Or sort of even more likely to succeed but also generate new problems,
right.
a robust ground invasion that was aimed at securing, supporting the rebels, and then ultimately ending the Assad regime and rebuilding a new political consensus. That, obviously, we know from very, very long, extensive experience of state-building projects that there's serious risk associated with that. Mm-hmm. As a consequence, it doesn't seem like anyone has the political will to do that sort of thing, let alone whether or not it would succeed. We can bracket that question entirely.
Right.
So those are the kinds of scales of actions that you would need to solve the broader humanitarian question. So if you think that military force is a useful tool only for accomplishing the more minimal goal of deterring chemical weapons use, but not a useful tool for actually saving large-scale civilian life because of political constraints or because of simply what force can and can't do, then it's reasonable to say that, look, we just simply can't make a difference in these particular cases. That's not the way the world is. We can make a case in this a difference in this more limited circumstance. And just because it's a more limited moral objective doesn't mean it's an unjustified objective to pursue. I think that's a reasonable way of framing the punishment case that's consistent with the idea that we have an obligation to protect civilians.
Okay. Now, did you deal within the second party, third... you didn't deal with... or I guess that kind of deals then with the second party, third party question, right? That by establishing a specific punishment norm, reinforcing a specific punishment norm associated with, or, you might even argue, establishing a specific punishment norm with regards to the use of chemical weapons, then you do differentiate it from sort of broader attacks against civilians that are associated with things that we really can't do in the first place, right? There is this unsolvable problem that we're simply bracketing off here. And this is a solvable problem. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, reasons you might... there certainly have been a lot of conversation about... the potential to which rebel groups may have, acquired certain chemical agents and so forth. I mean, nobody's taking this really very seriously, although the idea that rebel groups might be able to use some chemical weapons is not wholly absurd. I mean, it does seem to me that perhaps a point in favor of punishment is that, by and large, state actors are going to have access not only to the most effective, militarily effective chemical weapons, but also to the most effective delivery systems for those chemical weapons. And so that, in general, establishing a prohibition and a punishable prohibition against the use of chemical weapons, by and large, does de facto reduce capacity for state repression, right? That given that states are the most likely to use these and the most likely to use them to tip the military balance into their favor, much more likely than rebel groups, then this does sort of push back against the state repression, even if you aren't taking away all the tools the state has to repress rebel groups and domestic opponents.
Yeah, I think that that is certainly a plausible way of framing the norm-based argument. The concern I have about it is that no matter how precise any military action that the West takes will kill innocent civilians. I mean, there have been a series of reports about the Assad regime, not necessarily civilians, but nonetheless non-combatants, moving prisoners of war into places that would likely be hit by American cruise missiles or whatever.
Right.
Which means that the idea that you're going to inevitably kill some people who should not be killed to make a point to the international community and not to reduce particular suffering in the particular case of Syria, that is to say, save more Syrian civilians in over the course of that conflict, strikes me as morally extremely troubling, right? The idea that war should be a punishment tool for future regimes, and not if it's not also one for the current one. Like, you can argue that that's a knock-on benefit, but to say that it should be, it could be the crux of the case for war on its own, that is to say the demonstration affects it. And I mean, how many other regimes have, like, autocratic or non-autocratic, whatever, regimes have mm-hmm. chemical weapons, and they have the mechanisms to deliver them? It's a relatively small number. Mm-hmm. And so to say that to that relatively small number, that you guys will theoretically be punished if you use them in a large-scale element, but we're not even sure if the signaling effect is going to work, and to kill Syrians, innocent Syrians, unintentionally, but nonetheless, almost certainly and foreseeably kill them, strikes me as a very, very dubious way to think about the ethics.
Right. And so what you're doing effectively is building the punishment aspect of the chemical weapons taboo upon the backs of dead, we presume, Syrian civilians, right? Or dead even Syrian conscripts, right? Syrian conscripts have moral value, right? I mean, the Syrian private who happens to be guarding the chemical weapons station is legally a target of war. There's no question about that. And potentially would even be legally be a target. But he's still a guy, right, who has family and so forth. And so killing him, you are effectively building this moral case upon his shattered body. And so then... In your mind, the utilitarian logic of this taboo is, or of holding this taboo, sort of remains locked to the potential for dissuading the Assad regime from the continued use of these weapons in this particular conflict, from trying to achieve military gain in this particular conflict. And that's really what, you know, that we should be concentrating as much as possible on this narrow question of whether it can deter. And we should not, and we'll get to this later, right? But I almost fall apart when anybody talks about this in context of we have to deter Assad from doing this, right? I mean, we don't know what the decision making process looks like at all, right? And so making the regime unitary is always a mistake. But anyway, the question is
right. No, that's definitely true.
Right, deterring the mechanism of the regime from using these particular weapons for seeking military advantage.
Yeah, I think that has to be the primary objective of any strike if we want to consider it to be ethically defensible. And that, of course, brings the question back to, will the strikes actually work in accomplishing that goal? And it seems to me that there's pretty compelling reasons to think that both might be true. On the one hand, mm-hmm. There's an argument that was made in a recent... I think it was John Western writing a Duck of Minerva who made this, that he had some data suggesting that the Assad regime responded to Western threats. That is to say, when it looked like the United States was being a little bit more belligerent, mm-hmm. the intensity of Syrian attacks on civilians decreased. Now, of course, this data isn't public yet. He said it was preliminary and just mentioned it offhand in a blog post. Were that true, that would give us some suggestive reason to believe that the Assad regime... again, I'm using regime deliberately here, just
right,
Assad,
right.
For reasons I right. just mentioned, that the whole regime apparatus really was afraid of a broader Western intervention to degrade their military capabilities. On the other hand, the counterargument is simply, if they think they want to use chemical weapons, they're going to use them because this is an existential conflict. Mm-hmm. And the question, I guess, then becomes, does the record of the Assad regime suggest that it is more worried about the U.S. strikes, sort of degrading its ability to fight the rebels in existential terms, or the need for chemical
weapons?
Just wait
one second. Yeah.
Can I take the future advising files? Sure. There you go.
Right back. Sorry about that. Continue.
Right, or the need for chemical weapons to preserve the government against particular rebel groups. And I do have some questions about that second argument, particularly that chemical weapons are fairly limited military utility in a lot of circumstances. And so it raises the question, the much debated question in the last week, why did the Ghouta attack happen in the first place? If chemical weapons had this limited military utility,
right? I mean, to my understanding, or at least from the reports that I've read so far, or at least one explanation for that question is that they had been attempting to use them in relatively limited for relatively limited military goals, right? And so they'd been using what they thought were small amounts, and they'd be using them to incapacitate frontline fighters, and then to achieve sort of very limited tactical goals. And I mean, what maybe people are arguing, or at least some people are suggesting, is that this extensive use here represents something different entirely, right? Whether an intentional escalation of the use, which sounds wrong to me, for I think some of the reasons that you just sketched out, or a mistake by elements of the Assad regime, right? An unintended consequence of some order. I mean, is that kind of what you've been hearing as well? Is that
That's possible. The other way of thinking about it, this is coming from a recent, I think it was this morning or yesterday, Steve Cole article in The New Yorker about the Iraqi use of chemical weapons against the Kurds. And the Iraqi thinking at the time was that chemical weapons are so uniquely disturbing in the way that they kill people, the bloodlessness, the severe amounts of pain, the eerie calm and then terror of the way the chemical weapons descend in a particular area, that they would have a psychological effect that would deter civilians from engaging in open rebellion or something like that.
Right, so it's a straightforward terror weapon.
Right, and it's possible that regime, I can imagine, considering that there have also been some reports, at least suggesting to me, that the decision-making is disaggregated in the way that you were talking about earlier, that is to say that battlefield commanders, not battlefield, one step up from that, somewhere in the chain of command is the authority to deploy those weapons unilaterally. That someone like that made a decision that was functionally, we think that would be helpful in the fighting around Damascus, which at the time the rebels were making, it was, the 21st. So in the past 2 weeks or so, 3 weeks, the rebels had been making some advances in the Damascus area. Ghouta is a suburb of Damascus. So I can see why a commander who doesn't want to lose an important piece of territory near the capital city makes a determination that he wants to try whatever weapon he uses, and that includes a weapon of mass terror and destruction, which is the more rationalist way of thinking about what happened here as opposed to a mistake.
Right.
I'm not quite sure which one it is. And it obviously has implications for the utility of an American strike.
Right. We should step back a second. And so when we talk about convincing the regime and convincing the mechanism of the regime not to continue the use, I mean, the micro logic of this is that in the future, this commander who ordered the use of a particular set of chemical weapons will, in fact, be under either that the regime itself will restructure the authority lines for the use of chemical weapons so that this independent commander no longer has access to these kinds of weapons in order to launch this kind of terror attack, if that is indeed what happened. Or if there was an accident, then, again, the lines of authority are restructured within the regime so that there's much less chance of an accident. Or that you will have sort of a much more specific set of condemnations of within the regime hierarchy of this kind of behavior, this particular kind of error. And so that will sort of restructure the thinking of the elements of the regime that can launch chemical attacks. I guess we should here talk about we should disaggregate what we mean by existential in this context, right? An existential threat to the regime. Because, of course, the regime can suffer an existential threat without the specific cogs within the regime suffering existential threats, right? And so if indeed there are varying levels of authority over chemical weapons, over the use of particular weapons within the regime, just because there's a belief that the regime may fall does not actually mean that it's inevitable that it will use every weapon at hand in order to preserve itself, right? Because even if the regime ceases to exist, the people who are within the regime continue to exist and might make themselves particularly vulnerable to international prosecution, to domestic prosecution, whatever, in the post-war context if they make these kinds of orders. And so along with that thinking, right, even if you believe the regime is about to suffer an existential crisis, there can still be a certain value to reaffirming a norm of punishment around the use of chemical weapons, right? Even if the regime's going to fall, if that makes
sense. Right. Yeah, it's not that they'll do anything. It's a question of they'll do what they think would be helpful militarily in these particular cases. And it's not clear that in the kind of fighting that would lead to the collapse of the Assad regime, that sort of fighting would be one in which they're like, you know, at the time to just throw all the chemical weapons out the window.
Right. I mean, it has to be very specific circumstances in which commanders believe that the balance will be tipped and they will be continue to be immune from international or domestic prosecution if they use chemical weapons in this particular case, right? Because if they use them and they lose, then it's really a lose-lose, right? You can no longer say, well, I fought the honorable fight and I'm going to retire to my pension now under the new regime. It's, oh, heck, I'm running from everyone. But that brings up a second question, and probably one that's been under... And I want to get back to, I know you wanted to bracket off this let's go regime truck question because there's no political will, but I do want to get back to that. But what if we were to say that really the appropriate terms of establishing a norm of punishment for the chemical use of, for the chemical weapons taboo, around the chemical weapons taboo, can still take non-military means, right? And so we then focus on questions such as, you know, identifying particular people within the regime who gave particular orders or who were responsible, who held command responsibility in some fashion, and even if the Assad regime wins, to then pursue them to the fullest legal extent, which means, you know, sort of a variety of sanctions one could impose upon them individually, and also in a post-conflict situation, isolating the regime to the greatest extent possible for its use of chemical weapons unless it comes clean and turns over responsible parties and so forth, right? And so this becomes a non-military set of ways of punishing. I mean, what are your thoughts on the prospects for something like that?
Yeah, so I think that that's a hugely important point. And I think one of the reasons it's so important is because of the way this issue has been framed in terms of what sorts of considerations matter, particularly, like, so what I'm thinking of here are the arguments that this is, to a certain degree, this is about the stability and the efficacy of the existing liberal international political order, right? To what extent does international law, like the chemical, you know, the Geneva protocols about chemical weapons, to what extent does it actually hold sway over states? On the flip side, to what extent does going to war in this case by the United States, which would clearly, I mean, I haven't seen a plausible argument, let's put it that way, that this is justifiable under international law. The British government's argument was extremely weak, and I haven't seen a legal justification from the Obama administration yet, but I just don't know what it would look like. Let's say they don't come up with one. So it's under this, that's plausible, so it looks like this is probably illegal under international law.
Let's say they go under the legal justification that it's not illegal as long as the United States does it, which is actually surprisingly plausible under international law, but that's a different question altogether.
Well, it depends on what you mean by international law, doesn't it?
Right? Exactly.
but that's kind of the point, right? It's like if you really want to make this about making the Assad regime accountable to the international community through the mechanisms the international community has developed together and as sort of means of collective self-determination, it seems like you need to do things that are rule and order bound, or at least that you should to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, then a strike that doesn't have UNSC authorization seems like a way of to a certain degree, undermining the system in the name of defending it.
Right,
you say chemical weapons matter, but because international law and international norms prohibit them, but perhaps the central international norm of war that isn't self-defense is in R2P, which I guess talk about why this isn't R2P if we wanted to, but it isn't. UNSC authorized that anything like that isn't permissible and isn't a thing that states should do.
Well, and I mean, I think we should also reaffirm here that historically the notion of wars of punishment, right? Wars that are specifically intended to punish military actions that are specifically intended to punish, including airstrikes, including raids, and so forth. The grounds on which one can wage a war of punishment have steadily narrowed over the years because people have sort of come commonsensically with the notion that, hey, you know, I mean, simply punishing a regime by blowing up, punishing the people by blowing up a bunch of stuff, you know, should be the highest bar for anybody who's thinking about military action, right? I mean, in the 19th century, you had countries punishing other countries for failing to pay their debts, right? And the grounds on which you can wage a punishing war, even for this kind of violation, have steadily narrowed.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the non-military ways of reinforcing the chemical weapons norm, to a certain degree, strike me as pretty important steps to think about and discuss before attempting to engage in the military ones, because I mean, the response there is how much could any of those matter at this point? We've imposed pretty significant economic sanctions. Mm-hmm. Referring someone to the ICCC or the ICC seems kind of hard in these particular circumstances, given the blockages in place of any meaningful international accountability, by which I mean Russia. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do? And also there's Assad is going to be tried if he loses. Well, mm-hmm. if he loses, right? The only right. thing that matters to him right now is winning. So what do you care about these things? And I think that way of discussing and talking about it assumes that there's no intrinsic value to having a set of procedures and rules that govern the way that states enforce and practice international law. And it's why framing this as a choice between a realist calculation about American interests, in which, you know, you don't strike because this doesn't really affect us one way or another, this particular narrow strike, which is probably true that there aren't really strong American interests at stake in terms of a simple cruise missile strike, again, one way or another, versus, you know, the need to uphold the international order, I think sort of misses the question of whether or not this proposed strike is actually in keeping with the spirit and values of sort of the liberal vision of international structure, law, society, right. whatever phrasing you prefer. And I think that that's an open question that hasn't nearly been debated well.
Right. Well, I mean, and there's an extensive divide. I mean, there's a significant divide right on that question, right? I mean, and you know, tossing around the notion. I mean, there are two visions of what the liberal internationalist order should look like, or perhaps I should say there are two visions of what the United States behavior should look like within a liberal internationalist order, right? And one is a much more robust enforcer vision, and one is, you know, the United States bound by this process. And I think that your questions here sort of go to the crux of this difference of opinion about the way that the United States and its close allies should behave within an explicitly liberal internationalist order.
Right.
But let me take off from here and say that, you know, this conversation that we're having now, right, even to the extent of not, you know, even if you come to the conclusion of not launching a set of punishing strikes, leads us into an exceedingly bad place, right? That what we're looking at here, right, even if we decide against military action now, and really if we decide against any kind of extremely robust military action of the sort that really not many people are proposing because of the reasons that you gave with regards to political will, I mean, the Turks, the Israelis, nobody wants to conquer Syria. But if the regime manages to survive, if the civil war sort of boils down in what it comes to be, in essence, a regime victory, or at least regime survival with something, you know, with perhaps territorial boundaries within the country that are sort of governed by militia, that we are effectively 5 or 10 years down the road looking at a Syria that feels very much like Saddam Hussein's Iraq. In terms of its international isolation, in terms of the way that it will be able to confront and deal with international institutions, in the way, especially, that the United States and the other major Western countries are going to be attempting to deal with, or I should say, are going to have extraordinary difficulty dealing with it. And that, you know, in an important sense, there is no way that an Assad regime that survives is plausibly integrated back into the international system, right? That it's going to remain outside the system for as long as that regime survives. And then, you know, a corollary to that is, therefore, we should take strong positive steps to make sure that it doesn't survive. So, I guess, what do you think of that of both components of that argument, right? Both the first, it's going to be a pariah state, and second, therefore we should de-pariah it. Or, I mean, so take those in whatever order you want.
Yeah, I think the first one's almost certainly right. I don't imagine, in part because the chemical weapons norm is in fact a norm. It's not just something that is floating out there that people talk about abstractly. It actually is viewed by, it seems like, vast majority of countries and states as a line that's not worth crossing. And that the Syrian government, having done that, will intrinsically isolate it. And I don't know how you calculate the effects of that, but partially it may be that Western countries think that, so other countries who want to stay in the good graces of Western countries are going to treat Syria like a pariah state. It doesn't really matter. I think that it doesn't matter, you know, in the practical sense, because the Assad regime really will have isolated itself. And it will be able, it will continue
right, and to interject here, just to say, I mean, just a bit, the friendship of Russia and potentially even of China may be enough to save the regime from collapsing, but it is not enough to sort of establish the long-term prosperity of the Syrian people, right? I mean, that if the regime is isolated, it's really going to be isolated. It's going to be really problematic for everyone who lives in Syria.
No, because, you know, a few years ago, there were these sort of very robust arguments about engaging Syria, about attempting to using diplomacy, pull the Assad regime away from the sort of Iranian orbit that it had been playing in for quite some time, and there had been arguments that Assad was pliable to that kind of thing. This conflict has shown that if that theory were ever true, it might have been, it very well might have been before the regime faced a serious threat to its authority. I don't know. And it's not, again, it's not important because we know now that it won't be true going forward. That this state has so irrevocably damaged itself in the eyes of Western policymakers and of, you know, generally human rights observers and people that are concerned about that sort of thing, that they can't and will never have an interest or desire to be reintegrated into the world order again. I mean, maybe they might like to trade with the United States, but that's not, like, trade normally with the United States. It's not on the cards.
Right.
So they are, if they survive the Assad regime to a certain degree, it's done. It's done as a normal world actor, which means serious and terrible and awful pain for the Syrian people. Now, does that imply, too, that is to say, that therefore we should try to hasten the end of the regime? I mean, it would, if there were an option for doing that, that were feasible and wouldn't make the problem worse. And that's the concern, right? That's the problem with this particular policy issue, and why everyone has been, and by everyone I mean a large chunk of the generally pretty opinionated foreign policy commentariat, has been talking about this issue as being difficult in ways that others weren't. Take Libya, right. The most recent comparable type situation. People tended to have pretty strong views on Libya. Mm-hmm. That is to say, they thought, This is an intervention that's worth fighting, or this is a waste of American dollars and it's potentially going to backfire. Mm-hmm. And those arguments happened back and forth, and people had strong but divided views on this. Here, you see a lot of people who say, I'm of two minds on this issue, or I'm not quite sure which argument I find more persuasive. And the reason for that is because all of the potential options that anyone has talked about has terrible consequences, mm-hmm. or could potentially have terrible consequences, or be ineffectual. And if they're ineffectual, then, you know, to what extent is that an option? So it's in terms of saying that two follows from one, I think in the way that you outlined it, the more important question is what are the means to get from one to two? From this, the status quo is going to be bad, to we can do something that would be better than the status quo. And better doesn't just mean not Assad, it means an outcome and a world that is better than the world of Assad. Not Assad, not all non-Assads are better than Assad.
Right.
And that sucks. I mean, that's awful. That's the problem. It's like, that is an awful thing to say because the Assad regime is horrible.
Right.
But it's really, you can't talk about morality in this abstract sense of just thing is bad. And hence we shouldn't have it. You have to say, what are the available possible alternatives? And how do we get from those things to the other one? What are the consequences of doing that? What are the consequences of doing nothing? And you weigh those consequences against each other and you make judgments. It's just, this is a particularly difficult case for doing that.
Right. I mean, in some sense, we are still struggling with our post. With when I say we, I mean I think, and are you currently inside the Beltway? And so we're having a
yes.
A Beltway.
I'm physically inside the Beltway.
You are physically inside the Beltway. So I mean, I can say I'm not this Beltway thinking. I'm actually inside the Lexington Beltway, if that matters. But
that's what everyone's really talking about when they're talking about the Beltway.
Right. That we are still struggling with dealing with the vocabulary of power in the United States and to a lesser extent in Paris and London, which sort of treats seriously the prospect that there are things that are really too hard for us to do. And, you know, it's a vocabulary which has been re-emerging perhaps steadily since the mid-1990s, but maybe saw its nadir in 2003. But you're really kind of seeing it come through in here in Syria, people taking these arguments fairly seriously that, look, you know, as you point out, there are horrible things that are going to happen. We just can't do anything about them. And so that take the limitations of U.S. power seriously. You know, whether we would be having these same conversations with sort of a different constellation of foreign policy power in the administration is a different question. But, I mean, I guess what I am concerned about is what these arguments are going to look like 10 years from now. And I certainly don't hold to this view, but it was a powerful argument in 2002 and 2003 that advocates for war were making in terms of being able to say that there's no way out of Iraq's box except through war, or except through the rehabilitation of a horrible regime. And if we look back in time, 1991 seems like really a missed opportunity, right? It really seems like then it would have been easiest to do this as cheaply and easily as possible. And so I am curious whether, you know, the Weekly Standard in 2023 is going to be making the case that, hey, you know, this was where you had a free Syrian army that was able to dominate half the country. That there was a pathway to being able to defeat the Assad regime and to create a Syria that would be at least engageable by the international community, regardless of what nasty elements actually made up the government, in a way that is just unimaginable now without sort of the direct overthrow of the regime. I wonder if that's the argument we're going to be seeing.
Yeah. I suspect, barring the Rand Paulization of the Republican Party writ large, which, like, maybe that will happen, maybe it won't. Mm-hmm. I have my doubts. But mm-hmm. barring that, I think the Weekly Standard will make those arguments if we don't intervene in Syria. I think, conversely, if we do, you'll read articles in The Nation about the disastrous consequences of American intervention,
right,
and what would have happened had we just let it play out. And those articles will operate under the assumption that letting the conflict play out would have essentially the best case assessments of what might have happened in those worlds, if they mention them at all. And that's the problem, right, is that in any intervention debate, anyone that you ever have, the side whose policy option didn't get used always seems right. And the reason they always seem right is because you saw the bad things that happened from the policy option that was taken. You can see in Libya right now, for example, that there have been extrajudicial killings, a difficulty in setting up political order, mm-hmm. persecution of minorities.
Right.
What we didn't see after Libya was, because Gaddafi, you know, was intervened against, the slaughter that likely, I think, would have happened in Benghazi, and the protracted anti-Gaddafi insurgency that seemed to be a relatively possible outcome, given that he didn't quite have the military force to conduct robust counterinsurgency operations,
right,
and the rebels were getting arms from, they had bases outside the country and so on and so forth. And like that would have
this
been
is the, this is the but, your reality against my utopia problem.
Right. And everyone wants to set it up such that their side is the path less chosen that would have been better. And you look, and when you can point to concrete things that are terrible right now, the pull of that argument becomes very strong.
Right.
But you need to assess everything relative to the actual counterfactual baseline. So the thing, I think the most important thing to keep in mind when we're talking about Syria is to not let whatever position, when we're talking about two potential counterfactual worlds going forward, two or three or four, depending on how many policy options you assess, is to compare them realistically to each other rather than comparing them to vacuums.
Right.
And comparing them to just a world in which, I don't know, a neutral nothing world from nowhere. in which no things change. And I don't often know what the baseline is when people are saying a policy is a bad idea. They don't explain what that baseline is.
Right. So
in the first place.
Right. So I think this is a good jumping off point to then talking about what are like the two or three aspects of this conversation about Syria, and I think you've sort of highlighted some candidates here. What are the two or three most frustrating aspects of this conversation to you? What are the things you read on Twitter and it's like, I just want to shake my computer until it stops talking?
I've got a clear one, mm-hmm. Which might not be the same one as yours, but mine is the idea that the most important consideration in Syria is the extent to which it affects American national interest. Mm-hmm. That basically strikes me as crazy. And the reason is that when we're talking about the Obama administration's current policy option, it's one that by most independent assessments comes at very low risk to us. Mm-hmm. However, it could have real significant impacts on the lives of people in Syria one way or another. And it strikes me as morally obscene to say that in a world where there's a very minimal impact on our interests and a potentially significant impact on the interests of foreigners, that merely because they're foreigners, mm-hmm. their interests shouldn't count in this conversation. And that the most important decision should be made by the fact that it doesn't... I think Rand Paul said this explicitly, that like what matters is American foreign policy interests, like whether or not this affects us or advances our interests in a concrete way. I don't actually know what interests he's talking about. Mm-hmm. But that's because no one wants to specify what they mean by American national interests when they use it.
Right.
But that, to me, the idea that foreign people, specifically Syrians in this case, have no moral claim against us is the thing that bothers me the most. Right. It just seems clearly wrong.
Right, and that I think that argument actually has two corollaries, right? Because on the when challenged on that point, I think many people who sort of talk about national interest will then come up with, oh, but what you're proposing won't really help foreigners anyway, right? And so it's not really a debate. And then let's say, well, that's fine. Then make the argument that it won't really help foreigners rather than make the argument that foreign interests don't matter, right? But the when challenged, the argument sort of it becomes chameleon-like. And, of course, the Rand Paul case on this point, right, is extremely attractive to a lot of non-interventionists, but it has obvious implications for the other ways in which the United States engages with the international community that almost everybody thinks is a really fabulous idea, right, or really fabulous ideas, such as support for the United Nations, such as lots of versions of foreign aid, which, many people are actually really benefit. Many people agree are really beneficial to people around the world, right? That if you're going to take this argument seriously, then you have to take it seriously. And the fact that almost nobody takes it seriously, is kind of an indication that, on many ways, it's not to be taken seriously. If that
Yes.
rhetorically made any sense at all.
Sorry, go ahead.
And the other aspect of this is that I try to pound this into my students on the very first day of classes, that the national interest is not given, right? That we construct the national interest. And it may actually be in the national interest to uphold liberal international norms, right? To uphold a liberal... It just depends on your conception of the national interest, right? The national interest is not simply geared around maximizing American steel production, as someone
right.
in 1900 might argue, right? That the national interest is multifaceted, complex, thrown together by lots of different constituencies who have different interests, so forth. I guess the most frustrating I find is sort of unreflective comparisons with 2003. There needs to be care taken with this because there are good, reflective, thoughtful comparisons to be made with 2003 in ways that are productive for thinking about future conflicts. But not every proposed intervention is actually the invasion, conquest, and overthrow of another regime, right? And not every military intervention has the same dreadful implications of something along those lines. And sort of unreflective, sort of almost unconscious reference to the way the debate played out in 2003, to the consequences of the invasion of Iraq, to sort of the nation building and everything else that happened after that, are really not as helpful as you'd think in terms of evaluating the utility. of lobbing a few cruise missiles at, and I, you know, I'm when I say lobbing a few cruise missiles, obviously I'm maybe showing my cards a little bit in terms of what I think about this intervention. But even if you don't think it's a good idea, it's still not useful to compare it to Operation Iraqi Freedom. I mean, it's just, it's not the same thing. It's really not the same thing. It's something different. And there are some things that are similar, but it's not like even an apple and orange. It's like an apple and a blueberry, or some other much different looking fruit, or even not a fruit. I'm sorry, that got a little ranty, didn't it? It got a little ranty towards the end.
No, but I think it's probably deserved, because, I mean, everyone likes to rhetorically pick up the historical analogy that's going to resonate most with the people who agree with them. And throw it out there. And in this case, there are lots of people arguing against the intervention who think Iraq is a great parallel case. Almost no one's willing to defend Iraq as
it's going
to
be just as awesome as Iraq! Come on!
Yeah. You haven't even heard that from the Weekly Standard, folks.
Right.
Though, if they were to write that article, I imagine it would win Trolley Article of the Week. But No one says that, but on the
I hope the blogging heads people can get that last bit in the sound bit, because I want to be the guy. I want there to be a gif of me saying, it could be just as awesome as a rock. That'd be great for the organization, great for my
career. Out of context. Farley, just as awesome as a rock.
Right.
Yeah, but I think people do the same thing with other historical precedents, right? Like Rwanda. This isn't the same as Rwanda, where there were UN peacekeepers on the ground that had they been authorized to use force, could have made a substantial difference against a much, much less technologically advanced military that didn't, that, for example, lacked chemical weapons and was not particularly well organized, ended up being overthrown by a sort of ragtag intervention from regional powers, and that could have saved mass suffering because the Rwandan genocide was also an organized extermination.
Right.
This is a civil war that is having devastating effects on the civilian population, which it's a whole different set of circumstances entirely. And the point is just that not all two cases are the same. And for people to just pick up and be like, this is just like X example I really want that casts my argument in the most favorable light possible, is just about, I think, and I imagine you'll agree with this from your rant, the worst possible use of historical analogies in international relations, punditry, and thinking.
So wait, is your question which is the worst use of analogies? Or?
No, just the idea of cherry-picking the one example that rhetorically, superficially sounds like what you want, and what but most bolsters your case, but might in some very crucial respects not be similar to the case at hand.
Right. Well, that depicts a whole class. I mean, in some ways, the entire class of foreign policy analogies, at least as they are play out rhetorically. You know, they almost all share that particular characteristic. Or I guess, no. I mean, we should back away from that, right? Because analogy can be productively used, right? A metaphor can be productively used in these kinds of arguments, right? It just has to be productively and reflectively and thoughtfully used in these kinds of arguments. Which, you know,
right,
the
trope of this is just like
is
the problem. It's not this is in certain respects similar to, and here are the reasons that they're the same. It is the, look at this, we're going to war for weapons of mass destruction again. Look how that turned out last time.
Right.
Like that, or last time we turned a blind eye, 800,000 Rwandans were killed.
Right.
Like that is rhetorically very powerful, but intellectually, it's incredibly misleading.
Right. It's not. It is not theoretically productive. Although there are sort of theoretically productive treatments of why debates sort of shift in that way, right? And debates move in that way. Anyway, I think this has been a fabulous conversation.
I think so too.
When we were actually planning this last week, you know, I expected, oh heck, you know, the war is going to be over by the time we actually have the conversation. But it turns out not. Hasn't even started.
Turns out it's just getting started. Yeah.
So maybe we can talk again if there actually is a war.
Sounds. I was about to say sounds great, but that's just not an appropriate thing to say about the hypothetical of there being a war.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
Well,
but no, that would be very interesting. Let me put it that way.
Right. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Zach. And let's do this again sometime.